Questions?
Yeah.
1315. So, if that's the one I'm thinking about, that's the one where we have the crossover network, and you need to answer lots of questions. And it certainly starts out, I'm not going to bother to look up the circuit because I'm not sure it exactly matters. It starts out as a relatively simple sort of circuit where we have a series and then we have a parallel, and we've got that repeated. And if we call this whole piece Z1 and we call this whole piece Z2, it's easy to calculate Z1 and Z2 separately, and of course it's easy to calculate then the total impedance as the parallel combination of Z1 and Z2. Okay, so that all is pretty straightforward, and for any values of L, R, C, and omega, you really should be able to pretty quickly calculate the total impedance and be good to go, but that's not the question. So the question says, if I arrange things right, if I pick the right component value, say the component for L, I can arrange it so that the net impedance of the circuit is real, which is to say in phase, and in fact is equal to R, and is independent of omega. So there are three conditions there. And you know, one condition, one equation sort of thing. Three conditions, three equations simultaneously true doesn't sound very good. But in this particular case, it is true that these all happen simultaneously. So you can solve for any one of those and come up with the appropriate equation. Now, the trick is that these impedances, while I've maybe suggested that they're pretty simple, in fact, they look kind of a mess in complex numbers. And you don't actually want to do this yourself. You want to use Mathematica. And the problem with Mathematica is that it treats all of these things as being potentially complex. So we know that L and C and R and omega, those are all positive numbers that aren't complex. But Mathematica doesn't know that, and so attempts to use the pieces of Mathematica that deal with complex numbers pretty much immediately lead to failure, or at least nothing helpful. So, for example, if we wanted to calculate the real part of this impedance, just asking for the real part of Z is not a helpful way of doing it. And what I suggest is kind of a trick is if you look at all of the impedances, right? So the impedance of an inductor is Li omega, the impedance of a capacitor is 1 over I omega C. For either one of those guys, we can get the complex conjugate just by sending omega to minus omega. So one quick way we can do to get the real part of these impedances is to, I probably may get the details of this wrong, so bear with me. So if I take, say, Z1 and I use evaluate, and then I type Z1 and then I plug, this is means plugs, omega into minus omega, what I'm going to get is Z plus Z complex conjugate, which if you think about it, is twice the real part of Z, right? Because if Z is A plus IB, Z complex conjugate is Z minus IB, and so if I add them up, I'm going to get 2A. So this sort of trick to get the real and imaginary parts is kind of critical. Okay, so you can pick your favorite of these conditions and solve for it, and if you do it right, if you do the requisite sweat of Mathematica, you can solve for those various quantities. So the second part of the problem basically says, I want the power dissipated in one of these devices, the resistor, to be the same. At what frequency is that going to occur? Or express things in terms of the frequency at which it does occur. So this is, the overall story is this is a crossover network. So we want, say, the high frequencies to go to one speaker, and we want the low frequencies to go to another frequency. And if we plot the power that's going this way, we want it to look kind of like that, so that the low frequency goes here. If we plot the power that goes this way, we want it to look like that. Right? So the high frequencies go here, the low frequencies go there, approximately speaking. And this is the crossover point, the point where the powers are the same on both sides. So it's kind of a problem. How do I actually calculate the power that's going through this piece, which is kind of deep into the circuit? And I guess there's no reason you couldn't, you know, use Kirchhoff's laws to calculate what the current is that's going this way, but that sure seems like a mess, and maybe there's an easier way. So the power that's going this way, we can calculate just by taking the current times the voltage. Now, of course, this current is not going to be in phase with the voltage. The imaginary part of this current is going to be, say, a sine to this cosine, and so when we average it, we're going to get zero power. So really what we want for the power output is the real part of the current times the voltage. And of course, the current is just the voltage divided by the corresponding impedance. So the power that's going this green way is really the real part of 1 over Z1 times the voltage squared. So what we want to find this crossover point is the real part of 1 over Z1 is equal to the real part of 1 over Z2. And again, that's one of many equivalent formulations. So there are other ways of finding that crossover point, but I think that that's the one that's the most obvious.
So you break it up into the half ones that are being parallel?
Yes. So I think automatically, when you work this problem, you're going to calculate. So this impedance is just the series combination of the parallel combination of two things. And then we have overall the parallel combinations of those two things to get the over one. So I think it's perfectly natural to be calculating these Z's separately. And this is not, I would say, the typical Kirchhoff's law problem, right? This is the case where you can break the circuit up into parallel and series pieces, as opposed to writing down the sum of the currents are zero, the sum of the voltages are zero. Although, of course, you could if you wanted to. Does that at least give you a start? So,
isn't mathematical
thing R, like real? It is, but not usefully. So that's why I talked about up here. So adding the same thing where I've set omega going to minus omega, that's going to be a way more efficient way of doing this. Yes. So to calculate this real part, I would do it exactly, well, I hope exactly, who knows whether I've spelled the words right, pretty much exactly what's there. And of course, actually what I'm calculating here is twice the real part, but obviously if twice the real parts are equal, then we're good to go. Other questions? So again, the context for this problem is we've got an infinite solenoid, and the current is increasing in this solenoid, so the magnetic field inside of here is increasing, and so we're getting more and more energy that's in the solenoid. And of course, since the magnetic field is increasing, there's going to be an electric field that's going to be induced. So we've got both electric and magnetic fields present. And The problem asks, I think, for the self-inductance, or it just asks to check out. So if the energy is building up in this length L of the segment, then it should be flowing in from the outside, from the pointing vector. So what you want to do is to count, to pick up, obviously there's an infinite amount of energy and an infinite increase, so pick a length L, and then show that the pointing vector is pumping that energy into the solenoid. Does that answer your question?
No.
Good. What's your question?
The magnetic energy. Is that an energy density, or is that total energy? Would that be like a volume integral?
So what we want is the total amount of energy that's in this segment L. And if you think back, we actually calculated that three different ways for a previous problem. But I would certainly calculate it by volume, by energy density. And it's, you said an integral, but of course the magnetic field inside of here is a constant, so it's really pretty much just multiplying energy per volume times volume. But if you remember, it was one of the typed in questions where I had you calculating the energy three different ways. One's from the A field. So you could do it any of those ways, but why would you want to? More questions. So there's a rumor that people want the exam changed from Thursday to Monday. And I think the one person who hasn't been discussed is Kyle. Is that true? Everyone else had heard this story before? Has anyone contacted Kyle? It would be not a good idea if he shows up Thursday looking for the exam or for the help session, which won't exist. Okay, so this is true. This is the desired goal for the vast majority. That's not the vast majority, meaning me, is not in favor of that. So help. The help session was scheduled for tonight at 4, which is probably not a good idea if the exam is 6 days away.
Yeah, let's do 3. Well, you don't like Sundays.
Sunday is pretty much out unless it's like after 8. And then it's pretty late, right? Doesn't help much. Saturday is fine. Friday is fine. Thursday is fine. Thursday is kind of a big advance over the help session doesn't help a lot if you haven't thought about your questions. I'm amenable to probably any time that you're amenable to. What's the time?
I don't think I can do it. Saturday's gonna suck unless you want to be late. So and what was wrong with Friday? What do you have? Is that Friday? Yeah. Well, Saturday's Tuesday for a lot of people.
Well, Friday.
Okay.
Friday at 4 is what we're thinking. Is that what I heard?
Friday is the day 2.
Only for you. It has to be up before.
Yeah.
So we're saying 4:15, or we're saying?
Yeah, I'll take the.
Good. Okay. You could.
Wait.
And the cats.
Yeah, on Friday.
I don't know if the cats are coming or not. Maybe. Depends.
Just even one.
I'm only going to bring one. I'm not going to bring.
Yeah.
No, I was never going to bring more than one. Okay, so this is the trick, right? So understanding this functional form is the basis for how we're going to solve all of these equations. So this functional form corresponds to plane waves. So the plane of the wave is perpendicular to this k vector, and what that means is that if we move r along that plane, it's not going to change the value that's in parentheses, right? Because we'd just be adding a piece to r that is perpendicular to k, and so it's not going to affect the dot product. So this function corresponds to phase that is increasing in the direction of k and is also oscillating with the time omega. And it has a phase velocity that is omega over k, because that's just the wavelength times the frequency. So once we've got this, then it's super easy to apply Maxwell's equations, because gradients just bring down k's and time derivatives just bring down omegas. So what were differential equations just become algebra. So the divergence of E being zero just corresponds to E being perpendicular to K. And the divergence of B being zero just corresponds to K being perpendicular to H. So that's why we call these transverse waves. The electric and magnetic fields are perpendicular to the direction of propagation. They're in the plane of the crest. The curl equations just end up as these cross equations, and what these equations say is that the electric field and the magnetic field are perpendicular to each other and to the propagation direction. And with a little bit of work, we get out the phase velocity, and if we've got the phase velocity, we've got the index of refraction. And while we're putting in mu's every place, it's not really, we're really thinking about mu being basically mu naught, because if mu isn't equal to mu naught, then it's nonlinear, and we really shouldn't be playing these games at all. But just for fun, we're going to put in mu's to remind us how things go. So the S vector, the pointing vector that shows where the energy is flowing, it flows in the direction of E cross H. And if we crank this through, what we're trying to do is to get that quantity in terms of constants. So mu, we're thinking, isn't going to vary. C, of course, doesn't vary. So the index, the energy per area is going to depend on the index of refraction and the electric field squared. So the plan is to look at situations where we have light impinging on a boundary, and we started to look at normal instance where we shine light perpendicularly on, say, glass. So this might be air and this might be glass. And we just write down the boundary conditions, and we're off to the races, and we find that the reflected electric field is proportional to the incident electric field with this exact ratio. And it's kind of important to note from kind of 200 level stuff, is if E is greater than, if N1 is greater than N2, if we're going from air to glass, then we're going to get a positive number for this ratio. But notice I set this thing up with the electric fields pointing in opposite directions. So if N1 is greater than N2, we get a phase reversal if we're going to a more optically dense material. And contrary-wise, if N1 is bigger than N2, then we're not going to have a phase reversal. And if you plug in N2 equals 1.5 for glass, and you do the calculation, it turns out about 4% of the energy is going to be reflected. And, you know, therein lies a story for typically complex optical device like a camera. There are lots of lenses in there on the order of, well, for a microscope on the order of 10 lenses. So you don't want to lose 4% times 10 of your light. So you're interested in anti-reflective coatings, which were discussed, I guess, in 211. Okay, so we did normal incidence. How about we do at an angle? So we think about the same situation where we have light impinging at an angle. And we haven't really talked carefully about boundary conditions because we haven't needed to yet. But if there's any boundary condition possible on the two sides of this boundary, then that means as we move along this boundary condition has to continue to hold. So the change in time or the change in position along this boundary have to give exactly the same sort of oscillation. So that the boundary condition satisfied at one point is going to be satisfied at all the points. So the fact that the change in space along this boundary is the same for this wave, and this wave means that the component of k in this direction has to be the same for this wave, and this wave. The size of the wave vector in a particular material just depends on the frequency and the index of refraction. So the size of these two vectors has to be the same. The vertical component of those vectors has to be the same. And the consequence is that these angles have to be the same, so that the angle of incidence has to equal the angle of reflection. If we compare these two waves, so the component of k for the initial wave and the component of k for the refracted wave, crank it through and what we get, Snell's law. So angle of incidence equals angle of reflection, and Snell's law, those are general properties of any old wave as long as we have to have some consistent boundary condition. So to go further than this, to actually calculate what the reflected intensity is as a function of the incident angle is kind of a mess. And it turns out that we want to consider two possible polarizations. So if the light is going towards you, we could have the electric field, for example, pointed this way. That would be one type of linear polarization. Or it could be pointed vertically up. That would be another polarization. And of course, any other possibility is going to be a linear combination of those two. So that's called linear polarization, where the electric field is in a fixed direction. And of course, it has to be perpendicular to the direction of propagation. Another type of commonly existing polarization is called circular polarization. And that's basically where we take cosine of this polarization and sine of this polarization and add them up. And with that phase result, we get circular polarization. Light that, as I'm freezing the light and just seeing which way the electric field is at different points in space, it's going to rotate. And it can, of course, rotate that way or can rotate this way according to what exact linear combination I've got. So linear polarization, circular polarization. More generally, elliptical polarization, where the size in the y direction is different from the size in the x direction. Okay, so an additional complication of polarization. These are two choices we can make. We can write any type of light as a linear combination of those two. And The type that makes, I think, most sense to us personally is the linear polarization. So what we're going to talk about now is the reflection of light that is linearly polarized when it's incident on this boundary. So here we have N1, here we have N2. In this particular case, the light is polarized, so the electric field is perpendicular to this boundary. And that's called transverse electric, which our book calls S polarization. Another possibility is that the H field is parallel to this boundary, which is called transverse momentum, transverse magnetic, which our book is going to call P polarization. And it's not particularly difficult in order to calculate what the reflective intensity is, but it's kind of an algebraic nightmare. basically because you've got lots of different angles involved, right? You've got the refractive angle, you've got the incident angle, you want a piece of this H, but it really is just a matter of applying these same boundary conditions and doing a whole lot of algebra. And this is the result. So what we've got here is the ratio of the electric fields. Of course, the S vector, the power, depends on that ratio squared. So we've also plotted the E over E prime squared. So at normal incidence, there's no difference between transverse magnetic and transverse electric, so they have to have exactly the same ratio. And as we go to more glazing angles, the reflectivity is going to go to 1, both for the transverse magnetic and for the transverse electric case. But they're going to go in different directions, so the transverse magnetic has to go through 0 reflectivity at some particular angle. And that angle is called the Brewster angle, and it satisfies the condition that the tangent of that angle is equal to the index of refraction of the glass that you're going into. Okay, and we had my favorite story that says that the reflected light is generally speaking transverse, that the energy is generally speaking transverse electric. Way more energy in this polarization than that polarization. So if you're going to wear Polaroid sunglasses, you want to make them so they absorb this reflected light, the transverse electric light. Okay, things are slightly more complicated if we're going from glass to air. So first you might remember total internal reflection. So if you apply Snell's law and get an impossible angle for the refracted ray, then it didn't happen, and 100% of the light is reflected. So that's the circumstance for all of this light, right? So these ratios of E over E prime have gone to 1. And they've actually done it in a kind of a tricky way. That is to say, for these circumstances, E over E prime was a real number, and so it was either positive or negative. But it turns out that these ratios of E over E prime are actually complex numbers which have magnitude 1. So this is not, so E over E prime is not literally minus 1 for the transverse magnetic case. It's really equal to a complex number which has magnitude 1. Adds to the complexity. We still have a Brewster angle, otherwise it looks pretty much the same. Okay, so we could go through this algebra, but it really is a mess. And so my plan is to make you go through this algebra with the help of Mathematica. And it's not, with Mathematica, it's not that huge amount of a mess. As I say, the real problem is mixing Snell's law with the boundary condition. That's where you get kind of algebraically ugly results. Okay, so Fresnel equations is what this stuff is called. Well, we haven't really talked in detail about the boundary conditions because we haven't had to. But, you know, time comes for talking about boundary conditions, and that time has arrived. So we really want to do this in the most general possible way so that we can deal with all of the cases at once. And so we're going to bring back conductivity, right? So glass has no usually when you're dealing with light, you're not dealing with conducting materials because, as we'll see, conducting materials don't transmit light, so why bother to include it? But we want to prove, for example, that relationship, so we're going to bring back the conductivity and bring back lots more complexities. And the book is going to spend actually whole chapters talking about all of the possible ways that light can interact with conductors. And that's kind of not my plan. My plan is just to kind of talk about the greatest hits, as it were, of light flowing through conducting materials. So you're going to get kind of the short version of this as opposed to the longer version of it. Okay, so what do we got going for us? Well, we've got Maxwell's equations. So we've got the divergence of, well, let's start with the divergence of B since that's unambiguous. We've got the divergence of B being zero. And if we have a boundary then, and let me call this the normal direction. So you know that these equations are, they're not symmetric, right? Whether it's 1 minus 2 or 2 minus 1 is dependent upon what you've chosen to be the normal direction. So if I make a little Gaussian surface like this, what I discover, of course, is that the magnetic field in the normal direction on media 1 minus the magnetic field, minus because the outward normal on my green pillbox is pointing the other way. So what I've got is that B1 normal minus B2 normal has to be equal to zero. No magnetic monopoles. We've got Maxwell's equation that the curl of E is equal to minus the time derivative of B. So curl, of course, that's going to remind you of Ampere's laws. So what we're going to do is make a little Amperean loop. And I'm going to call this the tangent direction. And if I do this little Amperean loop, what I'm going to have is the, from this piece here, I'm going to have the electric field in region 1 in the tangential region times the length of that loop. And on the other side, the tangential direction is down, but the loop is going up. So I'm going to have minus the electric field in region 2 in the tangential direction times L. This is all going to equal the change in the magnetic flux through this loop. But I'm going to make this magnetic loop arbitrarily thin and then take the limit of epsilon goes to zero. So I'm going to get zero change because there can be no flux through something that has no thickness. So what we've got here is that the tangential component of the electric field has to be continuous across that boundary. Okay, so next Maxwell equation, we've got the divergence of D being equal to the charge density. So we're going to make a little Gaussian surface. Let me call this the normal direction again. And so what we're going to get is D in region 1, the normal direction, times the area, minus D in the normal direction in region 2 times the area, has to be equal to the enclosed charge, which is the surface charge density, times the area. So if we cancel off the areas and plug in that D is equal to the appropriate epsilon times the appropriate E, what we're going to have is that epsilon 1 E1 normal minus epsilon 2 E2 normal is equal to the surface charge density. Well, an equation that you probably are hoping to forget about is that the equation of continuity of current, that the divergence of the current plus the time derivative of the charge density has to equal zero. But if we're talking about conducting materials, we have to use this equation too. And let me kind of rewrite this in a form that's more like these other equations. So what I have is that the divergence of J is minus the time derivative of rho. So I'm going to make exactly the same Gaussian surface and make exactly the same argument that if I calculate the flux of current that's going through this far side, what I'm going to get is J in region 1 times the area minus the normal component of J, the current that's actually flowing through this loop, J in region 2, the normal derivative times that area. This has to equal the change in the current, change in the charge that's enclosed. Now, for everything we're talking about, we're thinking about time dependencies that are just going to bring down a minus I omega when we take time derivatives. So what I'm going to get here is minus a minus, which is plus, I omega times the surface charge density times the area. Okay, so if I plug in that J is equal to G1 times the electric field in region 1 times the normal, and here I've got G2, electric field in region 2 normal, is equal to minus I omega times the surface charge density. Question? Oh, it's not. Thank you. Plus. Okay, so we got two equations that involve sigma and E's. Let's bring them together. So if I divide this equation through by I omega, I get G1 over I omega E1 normal minus G2 over I omega E2 normal is equal to sigma. And now I've got these two equations and I can subtract them. And what I'm going to get then is epsilon 1 minus G1 over I omega times E1 normal. And I'll put it on the other side as an equal sign, equals epsilon 2 minus G2 over I omega E2 normal. Okay? So let me notice here, and we'll come back to this a couple of different ways. Notice that if we have infinitely conductive material on the other side of the boundary, this is going to be some finite number. If G2 is going to infinity, then E2 normal has to go to zero. We can't have an electric field in this infinitely conductive material. And we'll come back to that in a second. Okay, so we've got one last Maxwell's equation, and that's that the curl of H is equal to J plus the time derivative of B. And we're going to run this exactly the way we ran here, right? When we have curl equations, we make these Amperian loops. So if we make a little Amperian loop, I guess I might as well redraw it. Right, so here's region 1, here's region 2, there's the tangential direction. We're going to make this little Amperian loop, and what we're going to get then is that H1 tangential minus H2 tangential is equal to the current that's flowing through this loop, either displacement current or real current. But if I make this loop arbitrarily thin, this quantity is going to be zero. Unless I have infinite conductivity. Okay, so generally speaking, we're going to have the tangential component of H being continuous. But if we're actually talking about infinite conductivity, then we can have an infinite surface current that's going to be making up for that discontinuity. Okay, so the case of actually infinite conductivity is, well, not existing practically. Copper has a way big conductivity. And even though it's not actually infinite, it's pretty close to infinite. It really is useful to be thinking about the limit of infinite conductivity. And I guess I'd like to do that a little bit more generally than we've done so far. So what we've got is that I'm now thinking about the not exactly real case, but useful limit to consider of the conductivity in region 2 going to zero, going to infinity. So what we've got is the curl of H is equal to the current density plus the time derivative of D. And we know that the current density is equal to G times the, I'm going to drop the twos, is going to be G times the electric field, and D is equal to epsilon times the electric field. And the time derivative is just going to bring down a minus I omega. So what we've got here then is that the electric field is 1 over G minus I omega epsilon times the curl of H. So as G goes to infinity, no electric field in the corresponding conducting material. And then we've got that the curl of the electric field, the curl of the electric field is equal to minus the time derivative of the magnetic field, which is equal to minus the time derivative times mu times H. Well, if the electric field is zero, then H is equal to zero. Up or down? Okay, so in the infinite conductivity case, I hope I've convinced you that the electric field is going to go to zero and the H field is going to go to zero. We don't have light penetrating infinitely conducting material. So light is pretty opaque to aluminum foil or to lead or to any of those sorts of materials. But do notice that gamma rays are able to go through all of those sorts of materials. So we do want to explain what's going on for particularly high frequency light, but at least for low frequency light, it's not going to much penetrate the corresponding conductors. Okay, so let's go back to thinking about conductors in slightly greater detail. So when we were talking about conductivity, when we were talking about conductivity in the past, we were applying F equals ma, right? So what we had is that the time derivative of the velocity of the electrons, that's the acceleration, that was equal to the electric force, which was the charge divided by mass times the corresponding electric field. And while it's not literally true that there's a damping force, those electrons are going to be running into particles, and so we kind of model that by having a time-dependent term. So this tau is kind of the time it takes for the situation to reach equilibrium, and kind of in round numbers for highly conductive materials like copper, tau is going to be like 10 to the minus 13th, 10 to the minus 14th seconds. It really doesn't take much time to reach equilibrium in a highly conductive material. Okay, well, we can solve. You have solved, I'm sure, this differential equation lots of times. So we can pretty quickly write down the answer, of course, remembering that we're going to be assuming sinusoidal time dependence. So this time derivative is just worth a factor of minus I omega. So we're going to get that the velocity amplitude is the forcing amplitude divided by 1 over tau minus I omega. And the fact that this is complex is indicating that there'll be a phase shift between the driving force, the electric field, and the corresponding response to it. That's the velocity vector. So first of all, let's go to the familiar case, small omega, right? DC, for example. We had a formula for what the velocity was in terms of all of these. Well, now, so let me back up one more step. What we really were talking about was the current density. And the current density was the charge times the number of electrons per unit volume times the velocity of the electrons. And if we plug in what our velocity is, we're going to get k q squared, so it doesn't matter whether these are electrons or protons, if they're moving, divided by m, and we've got an n up top, and we've got a 1 over tau minus I omega, all of this times the electric field. So this quantity here is what we're calling the conductivity, and it can be a complex value, right? There's no reason that the current has to be in phase with the driving force. Now let me rewrite this the way we did before by multiplying top and bottom by tau. So we're going to get q squared and divided by m, and if I multiply the bottom by tau, I get 1 minus I omega tau times tau. And if you go back to what we were talking about for conductivity at DC levels, this is the formula that we had. So as we increase frequency, we're going to get the velocity out of phase with the corresponding driving electric field. So when omega is very large compared to 1 over tau, it's not going to be like the DC case. But frequencies that are small compared to 1 over tau, so frequencies that are small compared to 10 to the minus 14th hertz, they're going to work pretty much in the normal fashion. Now I've got one other definition here, which I think you've run into in Jim's class, and right now is not going to be motivated. It'll pop up again in a second, but I think now is as good a time as any to write it down. And that's for the plasma frequency. So the plasma frequency is given by nq squared divided by the mass times epsilon naught. Well, when I just pop an equation out at you for no apparent reason, at least you should think about how the units are going to work out on it. We certainly know that frequency squared better have the units of 1 over time squared. Does this combination of things actually have the units that are required for it? Well, when you do these sorts of unit checks, it's particularly with things like epsilon naught, which nobody bothers to remember the right units for, it's helpful to remember some formulas that involve these guys. So epsilon naught came up in the context of Coulomb's law, where we had that the force was equal to the product of charges divided by epsilon naught times distance squared. So this piece of this, who knows what the units of epsilon naught is, but q squared over epsilon naught better have the units of force times r squared. Force divided by mass better have the units of acceleration. So now we can kind of put together the pieces. So n was the number of particles per unit volume, so it's 1 over length cubed. Acceleration is a length divided by time squared. And we said that we had this r squared that was left over. So lo and behold, we are getting this kind of ugly formula does have the units of 1 over time squared, which is what it needed to have. Okay, so how many of you are taking Jim's class? Almost everybody. But not everybody. Only the important people. Okay, so it's either now or later, well, maybe later, we want to do the same thing for polarization. How does the dielectric constant depend on frequency? And we've already talked about how, since the square root of 81 isn't equal to 1.33, that the dielectric constant, at least of water, has to depend on frequency. And I think probably coming back to that is going to be the right thing to do. Okay, so now I have to pull something back, not from the previous lecture, but from the lecture before that, and that's where we showed the wave equation. And what we showed was that 0 was equal to the Laplacian, and then minus epsilon mu, two derivatives with respect to time. That was the wave equation itself. But then we also had this term that involved conductivity. So we had minus g mu one time derivative. If we did this to either h or e, we had to get zero. And of course, the plan is what's always the plan. We're going to guess that these things have time dependences that are like k dot r minus omega t. So the only thing that's a little bit new here is I'm going to let k be complex. So if k is complex, say it's equal to a real part plus I times an imaginary part, then this I and that I are going to go together to give a minus ki dot r. And this is something that is exponentially decaying. This would be an electrical wave that is getting smaller and smaller and smaller as I move into the conductor. And that's kind of the thing that that is the thing that is true, that for finite conductivities, waves don't propagate undiminished, they get absorbed. And so as a result, the amplitude is going to decay according to the value of this complex piece of the k vector. But otherwise, things work pretty much exactly the same. So if I take the Laplacian here, I'm going to bring down ik squared. If I bring it over to the other side of the equation, what I'm going to have is epsilon naught mu naught, and then I have the time derivatives from this term. So I'm going to get a omega squared. I bring down a minus I omega here, so I'm going to have a plus I omega g mu. I'm bringing this k term over to the other side of the equation. So that's going to be, and I'm going to use a kind of a tilde to remind myself that this k is complex. So that's just the algebraic equation that I get when I plug this formula in for either h or e. It's going to be a damping wave because this k is actually going to have a complex part. Let me divide this all through by omega squared, so I get epsilon mu is equal to ig mu divided by omega, and that's equal to this complex k vector squared divided by omega squared. And if you go back to what that same quantity was when k was real, it was just the index of refraction divided by c squared. Right? Index of refraction, this combination is 1 over the phase velocity squared, and omega over k is the phase velocity. Right? But this is now a complex index of refraction to go along with my complex k value. Yes, that was omega squared. Okay, so let's start with the low frequency limit. So by low frequency, I mean that omega is a lot less than this 1 over the damping frequency, and that has to do with what we're going to use for g. So in this limit, g was just equal to this stuff here. Okay, so g is real. If omega is small, then this is the big term. So what I have then is that I g mu divided by omega is going to be the complex value of k squared divided by omega squared. And now I need to take the square root of all of this. So what I'm going to get then is the is this complex value of k is going to be the square root of I, and we're going to have the square root of g mu. And if I bring that omega, it's really upstairs, so I've got that. So what's the square root of I? Say again? I didn't hear it. The fourth root of negative. True. Nope. Because I squared is equal to minus one. Whatever this is, if I square it, I'm supposed to get I. Well, it's not all that tricky. So one way to calculate this is to remember that, I don't know, you can take your favorite way of thinking about it. On the kind of the real imaginary plane, I is this vector like this, right? And I has to equal then e to the 90 degrees. And of course, that's going to work out in terms of cosine of 90 degrees plus I sine of 90 degrees. It's just equal to I. Well, it's really easy to take the 1/2 power of things that are already powers. So the square root of I is going to be 45 degrees is going to be this guy here. So if it's going to be at 45 degrees, the square root of I is equal to 1 over the square root of 2, 1 plus I. Well, I don't know, should you believe me? Well, of course, I always tell the truth, but let's square it just to make sure. So if I square this, if I square the 1 over the square root of 2, I'm going to get a half. So I'm going to get 1 plus I squared. And I can expand this out as 1 squared, and then the cross product is going to be plus 2i times 1, and then the I squared is going to be minus 1. Sure seems to be the case. Incidentally, if you think about it, there's also another perfectly good square root of I over there, right? If I take minus that same quantity and I square it, I'll also get I. So, yes, 1 over the square root of 2, 1 plus I. This vector here that is real part 1 and imaginary part 1, this 45 degree vector. Okay, so you remember that the imaginary part of K is going to determine the damping distance. It's usually called the skin depth. So what we can see is that the imaginary part of this K is going to be 1 over the square root of 2 times what's left over, g omega mu, right? Which I guess I can put all together as g omega mu over 2. Okay, so if the wave is then going to be e to, and let's call z the direction we're going, e to the minus imaginary part of k times z, then the distance that you're going to go and have z go and have this function go down by a factor of e, that's usually called the skin depth. How deep will a electromagnetic wave go? It's going to be just 1 over k imaginary. Right? So that's square root of 2 divided by g mu omega. So you remember that way back here, the imaginary part of K is going to give us this damping factor. And so to go down by a factor of E, we're going to go a distance that is 1 over KI, right? So if Z is equal to the skin depth, then we're going to have E to the minus 1, and the electric and magnetic fields will be down by a factor of E if we go this distance. So it's a ballpark estimate for how deep you can go into a conductor before your wave damps out. Of course, it never completely damps out, but you go through a few E foldings and it gets pretty small pretty fast. Skin depth. Okay.
What class is this? No.
I don't know, it's about 30 or something like that. So one thing that's maybe worth commenting about is, do notice that the skin depth goes like 1 over the frequency. So if we're talking about low frequency, say 60 hertz or 100 hertz, relatively small frequency, then we can have an alternating current over a relatively big thickness. But if we're talking about frequencies that are in the gigahertz range or something like that, then we're going to get pretty small skin depths. So you don't have microwaves that are going through the solid conductor of a wire. They're only going to go through the outer surface of that wire. Whereas, you know, 60 hertz, that happily is going to go through the entire cross-section of the wire, because the skin depth is going to be meters as opposed to micrometers. And what this means effectively is the resistances of a wire is going to increase with frequency, because you're not actually going through the whole wire anymore. You're only going through the top surface of it. And this, as I say, this becomes important at kind of the gigahertz sort of frequency range, which is more than we usually deal with in our own electronics courses, but is relevant to microwaves. Okay, so that's low frequencies. How about high frequencies? I told you I was only going to do the greatest hits piece of this. So at high frequencies, that's where omega tau is a lot bigger than 1. So think about gamma rays going through copper, for example. So again, tau was on the order of, say, 10 to the minus 14 seconds. So we're talking frequencies well above the frequency of light. Under these circumstances, if you go back and look at our formula for G, it's going to be nq squared over m, and now we're going to have that second term being the important term. So we're going to have a minus I omega in the denominator. So if we go back to what this says, is that this says the complex k vector divided by c squared is equal to epsilon mu, that's basically the speed of light, and then we're going to have minus So here we are. So we're going to have the I's canceling, the omegas are going to combine, and if you look at what's in the numerator, we're going to have nq squared over epsilon naught. We're going to have exactly the plasma frequency divided by the frequency squared. So this is omega, the plasma frequency squared divided by omega squared. So if we're thinking about this as traveling more or less through vacuum where we have some plasma, then this is going to be 1 minus the plasma frequency divided by omega squared. And this is nicely, if we're talking about frequencies that are bigger than the plasma frequency, this is nicely real, So I can take the square root of this, and I get a normal index of refraction that is 1 over the plasma frequency squared divided by omega squared, all that square rooted. So at high... Q squared. Okay, so what we have here is, yep, question?
Yeah, just about the transformation space, the plasma frequency in like most outer space tend to be much lower than the frequency of the outer space when it comes to like its refraction, right?
So I'm not sure what the plasma frequency is of interstellar space, but it's pretty low. It's nothing like it is for light. So we have no problem of light traveling through the interstellar media. But low frequencies can't travel through the interstellar media. So one of the reasons I'm not sure what the interstellar media is, of course, is that between us and interstellar in solar system space is we've got our own ionosphere. And that has a noticeable plasma frequency that's something like 10 megahertz. Say again? No, frequency of visible light is like 10 to the 14th, 10 to the 15th hertz. So hugely more than that frequency. So kind of the usual story, and I guess I would have thought that Jim would have talked about this, is that for frequencies less than the plasma frequency, that's when we're going to get complex values of K, and so we're going to get the non-propagation of light into that plasma. But that plasma isn't going, it's not a resistor, it's not going to absorb any energy. So what you're going to have is reflection. So if we shine frequencies that are less than, say, 10 megahertz from the surface of the Earth up, they're going to bounce off the ionosphere. On the other hand, FM radio is like 100 megahertz, and it's going to go through the ionosphere. And of course, visible light is way more than that. It's going to go through pretty much everything. So this is the familiar story that you're out traveling at night and you turn to the AM dial where the frequency is about 1 megahertz and you can hear a radio station from Atlanta. And what's happened, of course, is that that radio station has bounced off the ionosphere in order to reach Minnesota. It doesn't work during the day because when we have sunlight, we have this ionized layer that's much closer to the surface of the Earth. So only when the ionosphere has risen enough so that you can get this long distance bounce, and only for relatively low frequencies, does this occur. You're never going to hear an FM station from Atlanta unless you go to Atlanta. Now, I actually wasn't thinking about Jim's course. I was thinking about copper. So for copper, the plasma frequency is, well, I don't know, 10 to the 16th, something like that. But gamma rays, of course, have an even higher frequency. So gamma rays can happily propagate through copper. You also might worry about the fact that n is less than 1, which means that the phase velocity is more than the speed of light, right? Because the phase velocity is equal to c divided by n. So when n goes less than 1, the phase velocity is more than 1. And you know that nothing can go faster than the speed of light. Is this a violation? Because the phase velocity of a gamma ray through copper is certainly more than the speed of light. Problem? Not a problem? Yeah, so it's the group velocity. You can't transfer information faster than the speed of light. And if you take the derivative of this, because you remember the group velocity is d omega dk, if you take the derivative as opposed to just dividing them, then you'll get velocities that are less than the speed of light.
So when you say there's no way to
I'm going to say no. Say again? I still can't hear you.
It wouldn't be air.
Well, so I mean, if you could take a picture of a piece of light that has a phase velocity that's more than the speed of light, then if you could, and you probably couldn't do this practically, but there's nothing theoretically that would keep you from doing this, if you could follow this individual peak, it would outpace the packet, which is traveling less than the speed of light. So maybe that peak would be ending up there. But very soon, that peak is going to outrun the wave, and it's going to have zero amplitude. So we can only actually detect things if they're in the pulse, if they're in the group. So it's the group velocity, the dits and datches that you can imagine transferring by electromagnetic radiation. Well, so if you're talking about a beam, you're not talking about a pulse, I take it.
Right.
So if there's no modulation, there's no information transfer. Yeah, so yeah, this wave is going to be, you know, miles ahead, but it's the same as that peak. There's no information transfer. So modulation is required, and then it's the period of the modulation that you care about, and that's exactly what the group velocity is. So I didn't get as far as I'd hoped, so we won't, the stress.pdf I can't assign quite yet. I think it's 30. It's at least close to 30. So the handout that you got, you may have noticed that I never referenced it, right? So I will reference it in the future.